You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
What can the hardwiring of our brains tell us about love, violence, art, and why some people can't get along without their Blackberries? Well, in her new book, The Genius Engine, Kathleen Stein explains the outer limits of the inside of your brain. Her book is published by John Wiley, and I'm pleased that it has brought her to my show today. Hello.
Hello. Thank you for having me.
Is the prefrontal cortex the genius engine of your title?
Yes, it is.
Should I assume that it's located in the front of the brain?
Absolutely, right behind your forehead. And the dorsolateral parts extend to the edges of your eyebrows. And the orbital frontal areas are sort of right behind the top of the bridge of your nose.
So this is the bulge in the front of your brain when we see the brain.
Yeah, that prow that we have.
So what makes the PFC so special?
Well, for one thing, it's much enlarged in humans compared to the rest of the cortex than in other animals. Other mammals have something of a prefrontal cortex, but it's huge, and apes do too, but it is the hugest part proportionally. And it's a free-for-all area. It's not designated like the primary cortex to do specific things. It is a freelance area.
So what determines what will be handled by the prefrontal cortex as opposed to another part of the brain?
Well, the rest of the brain does to a great extent. It takes what's necessary and holds it. And plays around with it. It's a workshop of the brain. And its primary operating unit is called working memory. And that, you know, the most simplistic example of that is, you know, when you look up a phone number in the yellow pages or something and then go over to your cell, try and find where you put your cell phone and then punch it in. It's that temporary holding online operation, and the prefrontal cortex can handle a number of those sort of simultaneously, but or in sequence pretty much at the same time.
So this is where the balkanization of the brain ends, although maybe the brain isn't as split as we're told, left, right,
no,
and all of that.
No, well,
this is the spot which is allows me to speak, and this is the spot which allows me to see.
Yes, and it allows you to think on your feet or on your brain, as it were. I mean, if I say something very strange to you right now and you decide that you want to pursue that and you hadn't thought about that ahead of time, that's the area where that fires up. But a lot of the front of the cortex is not really, you know, hardwired, and a lot of it is called associational, but the prefrontal cortex is where it's the most associational of all, but it has this incredible capacity to hold things online temporarily and juggle them around.
So that means that this is where short-term memory mainly resides.
Yes, but I think it's better to call it working memory because it's not like long-term memory except it's short. It really has this capacity to... It's very flexible. It can change around. It can go from sound to visual and the combinations thereof all the time.
With so many things happening in our modern environment and all the things that we have to keep track of, are our prefrontal cortexes being asked to do more work than they might have in the past?
Well, who knows what, you know, the cave people had to deal with in terms of, you know, all the animals that they had to work with and their various things that happened to them. But probably, yes, they didn't have to deal with Blackberries and cell phones and the regular parts of life, children, cooking, all at once. And in fact, the laws that have been put in place about driving while talking on the cell phone really are addressing the problem of how much can the prefrontal cortex do at once.
Well, what about the other side of that? You're driving down the highway or you're walking for a while and suddenly you realize that you don't remember anything. You don't remember getting from here to there over the past 5 minutes.
Well, I don't know exactly what's going on there, but it's probably that your prefrontal cortex is thinking about something else. And in fact,
but it's still keeping track of this, even though we're not thinking about, oh, stay in this lane, oh, there's a car coming the other
way.
Well,
the prefrontal cortex doesn't like to deal with routine. So if something is routine, like walking down the street, it shunts it off to other systems that take care of that. But some of my favorite researchers have this little example about this is Jonathan Cohen at Princeton and Earl Miller at MIT. They talked about this example. If you're crossing the street in the United States, you just naturally look to the left. But if you go to London, and then if you look to the left, you might get bopped. So your prefrontal cortex has to come in line to remind you to look to the right in London. But after you're in London for a couple of weeks, it shunts it off because it does need to think about it.
So there are other parts of the brain that have to do with which way we look. What about love? I mean, is that prefrontal cortex or is that another part
of the
brain?
Well, there's been some imaging studies of people that are professed to be madly in love. And basically, the prefrontal cortex is pretty much turned off during love. It's not a strategic function, love. But those are very preliminary, and some people have said, well, those people are happy in love. What if you're unhappy or you're, you know, jealous and you're trying to get your lover back or something like that? But generally, ecstasy is not a prefrontal function.
Kathleen Stein's book, The Genius Engine, Where Memory, Reason, Passion, Violence, and Creativity Intersect in the Human Brain, is published by Wiley. Well, how much do we know about the prefrontal cortex? When did people even start doing research into it?
Well, it was called the frontal lobes were called the silent lobes until basically the middle of the 1980s. Almost all understanding of prefrontal function came from shotgun wounds, tumor removal, and of course, above all, lobotomy. But still, you couldn't really tell much because different people would have different behavioral reactions. So in the 1980s, a number of researchers started using new technologies, and particularly Joachim Fuster at UCLA and Patricia Goldman-Rakic at Yale started seeing this basic unit of working memory by using various electronic instrumentation. But the whole thing really broke open when imaging PET and functional MRI came on the scene around 2000.
But the way that people figure out what the PFC does is by looking at people who've had some kind of damage to the area?
Well, that's one way, but that's
fairly crude. You said gunshot wounds.
Yes.
I'm assuming that wars actually probably led to a certain
amount
of understanding.
Absolutely. Especially post the Civil War, when guns became more efficient, they could tell more what was happening because the wounds were smaller. But every war has produced, you know, horrific frontal lobe damage. But it's been so gross, as they say, so large that they couldn't really pinpoint various areas. And that's fairly recent with electronic probes and imaging that you can see that the prefrontal cortex is divided into a number of different sub-cities, I guess.
And so when certain things happen, we see areas of it firing off?
Exactly. Like when I mentioned the dorsal lateral areas right on the edge of the sides of your forehead, that's much more a logic processing area, whereas the orbital frontal and ventral media, which are lower, kind of the floor of the prefrontal cortex, are much more involved in the interface of logic and emotion. And then there's one area straight on the top of your forehead, which is called area 10, which may be the area of when you're talking about, when you're thinking about what you're doing, your self-conscious mental processing. And these things are somewhat divided, but they overlap. But they do seem to have, like in a city, one area will be more the garment district and another area will be more finance, but they're interlap, but they tend towards these kinds of functions.
Why can people with PFC damage score as gifted in the lab but then have problems functioning in the real world?
The tests that, in the past anyway, that were done in labs were kind of what they called structured test. If you were good at something, you probably other parts of your cortex and brain could come in to help you solve these problems because you knew how to do them from the past. But when you're out in the real world, things happen that you aren't expecting and you haven't quite, you don't have the back brain experience to solve these problems. They're called ill-structured problems, and we run into them all the time. And that's when the prefrontal cortex brings its ability to be a freelancer or ad hoc thinking processes together to solve a problem that you've never dealt with before.
What's the cocktail party phenomenon?
That's a very amusing thing, and it's a test that was done by researchers who were interested in IQ, which, although it's very controversial, it seems as if IQ function, you know, whether or not you have a higher IQ or than others or not, is a prefrontal and particularly dorsolateral function. So this cocktail effect is something that is, if you're in a party, I should backtrack. One of the main criteria of a good thinking is to be able to block out extraneous influences on your thinking pattern. That may be the absolutely basic thing about IQ, is an ability to focus. And in the cocktail effect is when, say you're at a cocktail party and you hear your name mentioned across the room, and how does that affect your continuing conversation? But in this study, these researchers did a version of that, and they found that indeed people that had already tested highly on IQ were not as much affected by the hearing of their name across the room in the cocktail
situation.
They
weren't distracted.
In other words, they focused much better.
But I would assume that the ability to multitask would also be a sign of intelligence, and listening, hearing your name across the room, and at the same time being able to keep the conversation going might suggest that that's a better approach.
Yes, but still you're able to focus on more than one thing. It's not that the one thing derails your thinking. And in fact, there's some thought that higher brain evolved due to the complexity of human social relationships, and those people who were able to multitask a lot of different human relationships at once were the ones that had, you know, better chance to breed, and therefore natural selection took its course.
Didn't people once try to explain the mysteries of the prefrontal cortex by coming up with the notion of the homunculus?
Yes. Well, that was a notion that took place but even before there was any idea about the prefrontal cortex.
I just mean that people said there was a mystery and they came up with this idea.
That who was in charge of, you know, your brain function. They always felt that there should be somebody, some entity involved. And as brain function was more and more understood, this entity kept being pushed further up, so to speak, into the brain until it was sitting there in the prefrontal cortex. Well, there's a little person in the prefrontal cortex that's running the show. But scientists don't like that, and it doesn't make any sense logically either. So it's been very exciting to researchers to see how much of the prefrontal function is exchange with the rest of the brain, and the rest of the brain can tell the prefrontal cortex what to do equally as much as the prefrontal cortex tells it what to do, so that there's this constant feedback going on, which kind of, you know, banishes the homunculus.
My guest is Kathleen Stein, spelt with a K. She's written about science and technology for over 20 years and was Omni's neuroscience editor for over a decade. She's also written for the New York Times, for Biotechnology, Newswatch, and UPI. And now she's written The Genius Engine, where memory, reason, passion, violence, and creativity intersect in the human brain. It's published by Wiley. We will continue our conversation after this. Thank you. My guest is Kathleen Stein. Her book, The Genius Engine, Where Memory, Reason, Passion, Violence, and Creativity Intersect in the Human Brain, is published by Wiley. Why did so many scientists focus on long-term memory as opposed to the working memory of the PFC until fairly recently?
Well, since they couldn't study the PFC in any kind of detail, they just didn't focus on it. Also, a lot of people function fairly well without it or without parts of it, so they really weren't sure it was really doing much of anything up there. So, and there wasn't this sense that of working memory. It wasn't understood. It was basically a British psychologist named Alan Baddeley came up with this model of what he called working memory with his executive and these two slave units that did the work of the executive. But it was just purely a model.
It's kind of like the homunculus updated.
Yes, exactly. But it wasn't until Joachim Fuster and Pat Goldman-Rakic started really seeing what these special neurons in the prefrontal cortex could do that they saw that there was quite a big difference between working memory with all this flexibility and short-term aspects and the archival aspects of long-term memory.
Well, just about every day we wake up with a to-do list. Maybe we haven't written it down, but it's still there. How does our prefrontal cortex organize that list and help us manage it?
Well, it likes to prioritize things, and so that you will have, say, 5 things that you need to do or 10 or whatever, but I think the prefrontal cortex only likes about 7 at most, but it will...
About 7? Even at a certain point, there's too much?
Yeah, at a certain point, it just sort of kicks over and you drop your grocery bag, so to speak. But it does like to... What it can do is remind you of the order of the things that you want to do and then tick them off and then shunt them off when they're done. And one of the main researchers, Michael Petrides at McGill, talks about this story that Wilder Penfield, one of the great neuroscientists of the early 20th century, told about his sister, who he was very close to, and she had a brain tumor in her prefrontal cortex and insists that he operated on it. And afterwards, she seemed to be okay, and she was a great hostess and a great cook. And she invited him over for dinner, but when he got there, there was nothing done. And she said, "I got all the ingredients, but I just, for some reason, can't figure out how to put them together." And cooking a meal and entertaining and deciding on a dinner party is very much a prefrontal task.
Well, we also find ourselves with the refrigerator open and wondering what we were looking for there. And we have to go through a whole bunch of things before we remember that we were looking for the butter.
Yes. And also the prefrontal cortex is responsible for being a kind of search engine. If you forgot something or someone says, "Were you at that party?" And do you know if so-and-so was at that party? The prefrontal goes in there and goes back to that party and searches around and finds out whether or not you were there or not. Whereas if you just ran into somebody and you say, "Oh, I remember you were at that party," that's not a prefrontal task.
What about autism? Is that a case where the prefrontal cortex is not totally engaged?
Autism is a really complex disorder, and obviously the prefrontal cortex is affected, but it's many systems, I think, are affected. I think things that are more specifically prefrontal are attention deficit and bipolar, schizophrenia, and obsessive compulsive disorder, but they are called in the field a sort of a frontostriatal disorder, because also the striatal basal ganglia subcortical areas are very involved, and they're very involved in gating, turning thinking processes on and off and organizing, and so you can see how this loop could be affected. And it's not just the prefrontal cortex. In fact, the lower areas may be more affected, but they have a profound effect on, or at least varying degrees of effect on, prefrontal function.
Because what we're seeing is prefrontal activities distorted, probably through faulty wiring or something of that sort.
It probably goes all the way back to genetic predisposition and environmental impact hit of some kind. There's always more genes than you think involved, and there's always something else. So it's never the gene for ADD or the gene for bipolar. It's always some more complex thing that makes it devilishly hard to understand.
You said earlier that the prefrontal cortex turns off during at least good sex. What about during sleep?
It doesn't seem to be on that much.
So sleep is the time, at least when we dream, when our short-term or whatever we want to call it, working memories, then get transformed into long-term memory.
Probably, yes. Uh-huh.
And the prefrontal cortex plays no role in that.
Well, not a large role in it. Also, there's a wonderful study done by Kalina Kristoff, who's now at the University of British Columbia, where she and her boss, John Gabrielli at Stanford, wanted to see what happened when their research subjects were not thinking during the resting stage, and they realized that the brain was very, very active when they weren't supposed to be thinking. And at that time, the prefrontal cortex is not particularly on either, whereas the temporal lobe is going crazy and the visual areas are going crazy, and except for the very area 10, that very personal meta area, the prefrontal cortex wasn't really activated. So her idea is that's where you're kind of putting the story of your life, kind of mixing it up and putting it together and having your daydreams and your flow of consciousness, and the prefrontal cortex waits till it's needed. At that point, it's not really on. But when it comes on, all of that is operating too.
Has anybody done studies on how that works for someone who's writing fiction, for example? You teach writing. Or somebody who's painting a painting or writing music?
There have been some studies about music, and there's some sense that the prefrontal cortex keeps a map of chromatic scales in its bank, so that when you are listening to a music, you recognize it in any key. You also recognize when somebody made a crashed a chord in the wrong place. But as far as being in a scanner when someone's doing anything like this, I don't know about it. It'd be very interesting to see it done. And there's been some very interesting work to suggest that art itself is a way of the brain revealing its unconscious patterns to us, and that's why we love it so much.
My guess is Kathleen Stein. Her book, The Genius Engine, is published by John Wiley. This is WNYC at 93.9 AM 820. We're online at WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. You say that when we enter a restaurant, we tend to know exactly what the rules are. And the prefrontal cortex helps us accomplish that, even if we've never been in the place before or that kind of a restaurant before?
Yes, apparently. There are a lot of neurons that Earl Miller's done a lot of work with this at MIT that like to categorize things. And the prefrontal cortex neurons are really good at that. And they give you the general template of what you're supposed to do, allowing for all the flexibility so that you know if you're going to a four-star restaurant, say La Chanterelle, or you're going to a fishing shack, you know the basic rules, which are, looking at the menu and ordering and tipping and paying and everything, even though you can deal with the flexibility of ordering in these places. And that's another prefrontal, one of the genius things about the prefrontal cortex is it doesn't keep the specifics of each restaurant that you go to and how to deal with that restaurant alone. It just gives you the general rules.
So it allows us to generalize.
Yes, absolutely, and be flexible in your generalizations so that, as Earl said, if you have a category of, say, transportation, when the Segway machine is suddenly brought into being, you can categorize that as transportation without going through a lot of mental computation.
You said earlier that chimps have prefrontal cortexes, but not as developed as humans. Weren't studies done in which they were shown to be confused about the differences between dogs and cats?
Well, actually, they were trained to, Earl Miller was trying to, investigate these categorizing neurons of the prefrontal cortex, and they were trained monkeys were trained using a kind of morphing technology to know the difference between dogs and cats, and they never met any dogs or cats, but they were trained to recognize the various categories. And these morphing, they would have a screen, and the dog, whatever kind of dog, would morph slowly into a cat, and the prefrontal neurons that buzzed for the dog would buzz right up until the creature on the screen was no longer recognizable as a dog, and then as it slowly became a cat, the cat neurons would buzz. And, you know, I tried doing that and when I was there, and I couldn't really tell at some point whether it was a dog. And they said that monkeys are actually better at it than I was.
So they have rather advanced PFCs in
some
cases.
Maybe, but they've been trained to do this.
But we can still, I mean, we spot that a Chihuahua and a St. Bernard are different, and yet they're both dogs.
Yes.
And we can spot different breeds of cats, but know that they're all cats.
Yes.
So I wonder whether that's something that is instinctive. Is that part of a genetic memory?
Yeah, I think it's built into the prefrontal abilities.
Can you tell us about the Stroop test?
This goes back to the idea of focus and ability to block out what is wrong and go for what's right. The Stroop test is built, was created by this, you know, sort of he was a preacher, a fundamentalist preacher, but he was also a psychologist in Tennessee at what's now Vanderbilt in 1935. It's a test where if you look at a color word, say the color red, and during the test it says name the color of the word rather than the word, and the color of the word is green, your brain basically does not want to, it wants to say red, even though they've asked you to name the color of the word. So this is a kind of rote thing. You've been trained all your life to say red, and if the test says, say, the color of the word, it has to stop and think. And
Jasper John's painted paintings using this whole idea.
Oh, you're right. Absolutely, yes. And the Stroop test has been used forever, since 35, and people who want to know about how their brain function, how their attentional abilities and their flexibility is working, do the Stroop test, and it's been used on Mount Everest and other places to see how brain functions.
Well, I have always thought that there was a certain amount of chemical change that occurs. For example, on some days I will be reading something out loud on the air and not make a mistake. And then there are other days that I'll look at the word the and read of and have no idea of why that happened. And I think, well, there's something that's happened chemically, but could that be, again, something that's prefrontal?
Well, I mean, the whole brain is brought into play. And certainly if fatigue can affect prefrontal function, just like if you're doing the Stroop test or, at 8,000 meters, it's going to affect your prefrontal cortex. Or you may be just thinking about something else. You may have, packages or more little tops that you're spinning in your PFC at the same time that day, or a whole bunch of things. Certainly brain chemistry is at play, and dopamine and serotonin are very involved, as well as excitatory neurotransmitters. But it may be that you just have more things going on subconsciously.
That's the excuse I give myself anyway. Too much on my plate. What can Vinod Goels, research tell us about reason?
He's done some really exciting work, very creative work. Vinod Goel at York University in Toronto, and he wanted to see if he could really tell which parts of the prefrontal cortex were involved in logical deduction and inference, induction, and also what part things like belief and emotions played in your rational thought. And he found that much of inductive reasoning was lighting up the left dorsolateral prefrontal cortex, which was not surprising, but that if it became kind of a strange kind of, if the syllogism was odd, then the right dorsolateral came into play, and the right there is quite a bit of asymmetry in the prefrontal function in terms of the right does seem to deal more with the novel and the bizarre aspects, and the left is much more your daily kind of default logical system. And
so different kinds of jokes may have fire off different parts of the prefrontal cortex?
Well, certainly he did this study, and puns are basically very much left because, you know, a lot of your language functioning is in the left frontal lobe. But then when the jokes were particularly weird, the right would fire up. But when you really enjoyed them, then it would be a ventral-lateral area that lit up too, which he calls his comedy central, because that's part of your reward system, and the ventral lateral really gives you this kind of buzz of laughter when it realizes the logical ridiculousness of the joke.
Now there's an old cliche about creativity and madness, academic genius, artistic genius. Does that play out here in
yes,
these studies?
Yes, it does. There's a lot of evidence that bipolar tendencies, anyway, are at play in a lot of creativity, and there's been some attempt to figure out what's going on in the prefrontal cortex. Is it a kind of relaxation of some of its natural function of kind of suppressing things that don't seem quite as logical as they should, and perhaps there is a kind of more broadband spectrum of information that's coming into some people's brains that makes them put together unusual relationships. And and there was the case of Edward Muybridge, the great photographer of, you know, stop action animals and humans, and he had suffered a brain injury, and Arthur Shimomura, neuroscientist at Berkeley, did this wonderful monograph of Shimomura and found out that his photographic career only took place after the brain injury, probably to his orbital frontal area, because he was thrown out of a stagecoach and hit a rock.
Just one more question, and this was sent in by a listener. Does drug use affect the PFC?
Because of its huge dependency on dopamine or serotonin, yes, any kind of...
So different drugs will have different
impact. They will have different effects, but they will certainly affect its function.
Kathleen Stein's book, The Genius Engine, Where Memory, Reason, Passion, Violence, and Creativity Intersect in the Human Brain, is published by John Wiley & Sons, and I want to thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you.